You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. 2 weeks ago today, the Creek Fire broke out in the Sierra National Forest. It's been destroying property and pumping smoke and ash into the air ever since. Joined now by the Bulldog Fire in the Dinky Lakes Wilderness and the Sequoia Complex Fire, which is currently threatening the town of Three Rivers in Tulare County. To better understand why this year's wildfires are so large, numerous, and devastating, I spoke with Mike Thune, Fire Information Officer for the Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks, Adam Hernandez, Wildland Fire Technology Instructor at Reedley College, and John Abatsoglu, Associate Professor of Climatology at UC Merced. John, I'd like to start with you. You study drought and fire and the impact of climate on the West. How predictable was this fire season?
Elements of this season were quite predictable, unfortunately. The ingredients for a large fire season have been being built over the past several years. And in this year in particular, we've had a very warm year. We had low precipitation year across much of Northern California and into Oregon. And that, along with a couple pretty high-level critical fire weather events, really set the stage for this. So even though we are talking about an unprecedented fire season in the modern record, it's unfortunately a little bit predictable. We knew that one of these years we would see a year like this. So I think that we are surprised. There's a lot of impact, but the reality is we sort of knew this was coming.
So I would like to dive into some specifics about the fires that are currently happening here in the Valley. And Mike Thune, I'd like to shift the conversation to you. What can you tell us about where things stand with the Sequoia Complex Fire? And I should note that we are having this conversation on Thursday afternoon, and I appreciate the fact that these fires move fast and conditions change quickly. But if you could give us a general sense of where things stand, I think that would be helpful.
Sure. This is Mike Thune. When it comes to the Sequoia Complex, or the SQF Complex as it's formally known, things with that fire are very dynamic. You're looking at a large-scale wildfire that's over 100,000 acres that's not only impacting areas locally, but also it's impacting the entire region when it comes to air quality. And so these wildfires that you're seeing across the Sierra Nevada aren't just isolated to those communities they're directly impacting, but those wildfires are also having a huge impact all across the state and even places outside of California.
And where do things stand as it pertains to resources?
When you look at the resources for the SQF complex, there's over 1,000 personnel assigned. And when you look at the whole nation, as of this past week, there were over 30,000 people assigned to fires across the United States. That's a lot of resources that are looking at fighting these wildfires, but it also shows how many wildfires there are across the entire nation.
Adam Hernandez, you spent 17 years working with fire in the Sierra Forest, and I'm hearing from those who are fighting the Creek Fire that they have never seen fire behave the way this fire has. What makes it so different?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of factors that come into play, from climate to fuel loading, to some of these record-breaking weather trends that we've been having this summer, the low precipitation, and just the complexity of the terrain that these fires are starting in. And then, on top of that, the initial attack response and having folks at the ready when these fires are starting, and there's already multiple large incidents across the state, things are spread very thin. And so it makes it difficult to get that initial attack response on these fires and get a grasp on them early. And then even once you do get folks on the fire lines, they're faced with tons of challenges with, resistance to control due to the large fuel loadings, and then just temperatures and conditions of fuel dryness that just, propagate spotting and fire movement that's very aggressive. So it makes it challenging. There's lots of layers that are all kind of putting everything into alignment and creating a lot of challenges for the suppression folks on the ground.
I'd like to get into some of those layers. And John Abatsoglu, I'm going to point this conversation toward you. Given that you research how climate affects wildfire behavior, water, and agriculture, how has weather contributed to the fire outbreak that we're seeing, not just here in the Valley, but throughout the Western United States?
Yeah, weather and climate are two of the more dynamic elements that contribute to fire activity. Either weather through the combination of strong winds, a very unstable atmosphere that promotes plume growth that we've seen recently on some of these fires locally, and then, of course, sort of year-to-year variability in terms of how dry fuels are, and then in some cases, sort of the buildup of fuels due to a wet year. We do know, and it's not true just here in California, but across much of the globe, the ingredients for fire are pretty similar. You need to have enough fuel on the landscape. You need those fuels to be dry enough, and you need ignitions. And when those three factors come into alignment, particularly where there's some additional weather, it is very challenging, like Adam mentioned, for suppression to contain them, especially when it's spread across such a broad geographic range.
Adam, you spent a lot of time working with the U.S. Forest Service overseeing prescribed fire and fuel management for the Sierra Forest. I'm curious about your thoughts about the politics that have been injected into the conversation about wildfire. I mean, like everything else in our society, it has become political, with some blaming climate change and others arguing that these fires are a function of poor forest management. I would assume, given your experience, that you would reject the simplification of this fire outbreak as simply, you know, one or the other situation. Can you just speak to that debate going on right now?
Yeah. I guess the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, the causes of these, you know, these massive fires that we're having now isn't from one group or another. Like, we have to think about our culture as a whole and how we started integrating into the landscape 100 years ago. Before we were here, you know, a lot of people know that fire was natural on the landscape. When you start introducing urban interface and some of the resource values out there that you're trying to protect, and the reaction is to start saving, you know, or putting out fires, then you start kind of building on it. But it wasn't, you know, the land management agencies alone that said, hey, we need to put the fires out. It's all the kind of more economics there that's too, is the users of the forest, the wood products that come out, the hydroelectric, you know. And so it's for our culture and our societies that we've come to this point that we're at, because we all have different needs of the land. And meanwhile, the land management agencies are attempting to do their best. And there's policies such as NEPA that put sideboards on how you go about doing the treatments on the landscape. And then that kind of causes a little bit of difficulty to implement some of these fuel strategies and on and on. So I think, you know, we just need to look at it in the fact that, you know, we have our culture in the West here and on how we manage the land, how we interact with the landscape. And because, you know, we have these things that we value, it makes it difficult to, you know, let's say, you know, add prescribed fire to the landscape. So one example would be if there were no houses or there was no infrastructure values, you know, that we could damage through prescribed fire, we could let prescribed fire just go across the Central Sierras like it used to, and it wouldn't have any threat, and we could manage it appropriately. But the challenge becomes is there's a lot of intermix in there. And so it doesn't make it as easy to apply these broad applications of prescribed fire. And so that's no fault of anybody in particular. That just has to do with the way that we enjoy our society and utilize the forests. So it's it is difficult to hear that people think it's one group or another that's the causal factor of this, you know, when in reality it has to do with, you know, many different things and many different interests on the landscape. And, you know, a lot of times it really kind of comes back to economics as well, because everybody out there has the will to do these types of treatments. I wouldn't say there's any doubt against that. We all have the will to do the treatments from the agencies.
And when you say treatments, though, do you mean prescribed burns?
I'll say prescribed burns, you know, mechanical thinning, vegetation management, all those things that will reduce the fuel loadings and make the forest more healthy. There's not a lack of will. It's just, you know, a lot of times it's tough economically to do that when the timber that needs to come off the hillside has nowhere to go, you know, for the mills or biomass or whatever. You know, a lot of the bug-killed trees had no value. And so they had nowhere that they could go and take them. So it kind of becomes an economic issue as well.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. We're talking about wildfire with John Abatsoglu, Associate Professor of Climatology at UC Merced, Mike Thune, Fire Communication and Education Specialist at the Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks, and Adam Hernandez, Wildland Fire Technology Instructor at Reedley College. Mike, I would like to turn the conversation to you. This moment with the air quality and just the overwhelming number of fires that are popping up throughout the West feels apocalyptic. But I think something that I would like to keep in mind, or I'm trying to keep in mind, is that fire is part of the ecosystem of the forest. And so can you tell us about what these fires are going to mean for our forest moving forward? It feels like everything's just burning to the ground, but what actually will come next?
So when it comes to how we look at the forest, especially during fires and then afterwards, a lot of the things that Adam mentioned and how we manage the forest has to be looked at differently. As Adam was mentioning, fires have burned in the Sierra Nevada for thousands of years. And one of the challenges that we face is a broader public acceptance of how we need to manage the fires, both during these large-scale wildfires and then not only after how we have to manage the ecosystem, but then also what it means for the next time. And part of that comes into is what is right for those areas. Currently in Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks, we have two wildfires. One's called the Rattlesnake and the other one's called the Moraine. And both those wildfires were naturally caused, meaning they're started by lightning, and are only being staffed in a very minimal way, using what we call a confine and contain strategy, which is using rocks and other natural barriers. One of the reasons we're doing that decision strategy is because there's no threat to life or property with those fires. So we don't want to put valuable resources right now on fires that are literally in designated wilderness, instead of having those firefighters work where there are those wildland urban interfaces that Adam was mentioning, because there is threats to life and property, especially when it comes to fires like the creek or the SQF complex. At the same time, it's not until after the fire that we really know what the fire did or didn't do. I think, generally speaking, people have this vision of almost like the opening from the TV show Bonanza, where everything in that fire footprint is completely burned. And that's not always the case. Some of it has to do with where it's burning, the types of vegetation it's burning through, has to do with what the weather's like that very day, what the wind's like, and the overall amount of vegetation there is, as both the other panels were mentioning. The other part of it, it comes to, well, what does this mean for us long term? And within the National Park Service, we've been doing prescribed burning in the Sierra Nevada for over 50 years. And one of the things that we're starting to see change is the acceptance of that prescribed burning. And one of the biggest barriers to that acceptance is the air quality. So we generally find that it's in the fall or the spring is when our best windows are to do that prescribed burning, because that's also when we have the people available to do it. At the same time, we do get pushback from the public, because we have to start looking into our prescribed burning program for this fall. Are we going to actually do prescribed burning this fall when there's already been so much particulate matter put up into the atmosphere this year with these wildfires? Because people do want a breathing break, so to speak. They want that opportunity to have those clear skies. But the reality is, unless we do that proactive management and we have a program where we are able to allow nature to take its course in some of these fires, or to have more prescribed burning, we're just going to be playing catch up. And that catch-up is going to come in the face of large-scale wildfires.
John, do you think this fire might lead to a cultural change when it comes to our relationship as a society with prescribed burns and forest management?
Yeah, I mean, I think Mike hit it on the head there, right? We right now are in the midst of our fourth or fifth week of just oppressive air quality here across the San Joaquin Valley, and realistically, this is across much of California. And one of the questions that I think the public is going to have to ask themselves is, how do they want their smoke? Do they want it all at once, or are they okay with having a little bit of smoke in the off season when there actually is going to be a little bit more mixing? So I think this is potentially a turning point in sort of viewing both the public acceptance of prescribed fire and also realizing that not all fire is bad. There's fire is a natural part of our landscape, but what we really want to do is sort of have more control over what burns, and that is to reduce some of the sort of the fires that really impact people, either directly or indirectly through air quality. So this is an interesting turning point. We will see what's going to happen. I think we do know what we need to do. Like Adam was mentioning, we know what we're supposed to do on the landscape. It does seem like it's a lot of it's about economics, in that in order to do this, it really requires a massive effort, and it's not a one-time effort. It's continual effort, putting more resources for sort of fire prevention.
Adam, do you agree?
No, I absolutely agree. You know, I think the turning point needs to be that we just embrace this is what we need to do to move forward as a culture. And, you know, the challenge with a lot of the land management agencies is just the institutional barriers that exist that slow down the will to do the work. And we need to be more flexible in the way that we go about doing it. We need to be more fruitful with the resources that we put forth, whether it be money or personnel or, you know, organizational structures to move this fuels reduction program forward. And I think that's the way, you know, we need to be proactive. The prevention element is the pre-treatments, right? If you do the pre-treatments, you know, maybe you'll start reducing the costs of the suppression if you start making those larger gains.
So as you all have mentioned, there are so many elements that have contributed to this moment related to weather and drought and conditions in the forest, and it goes on and on and on. But I would like to talk again about climate change a bit more. You know, John, we're used to talking about climate change as something that we collectively should try to prevent. But of course, we're past that point now. It's happening. So while we can talk about how to slow climate change still and how we could reverse the trends, it seems that we also need to be having a conversation about how do we adapt to the current reality. And from that perspective, what should we be doing in acknowledgement that we are going to continue to have these series of extreme drought periods?
Yeah, and this is certainly a question that is going to have a different answer depending on exactly where we're talking and what sector we're talking, but we're talking about fire. So from the fire side, we do know that the deck is stacked for more fire in the future. Not every year, not every year is going to look like this, even in a warming climate. We're going to have years like we saw last year where the conditions were not aligned. And so those actually may be years to implement a little bit more of these preventative strategies. Those are years where maybe the public is not sort of smoked out by fire for, you know, months on end. And those may be years where we have conditions that are conducive to conducting more of these prescribed fire treatments. I think that you're right in that we are already in the midst of climate change. Things are going to continue to hasten. We can do things to adapt, at least to mitigate some of the impacts as it pertains to fire. And that's primarily going to occur through sort of the fuel side of the equation.
This is Mike, and I absolutely agree with what John's saying, because when we have those years where there is less wildfire activity, we are looking at options across all land management agencies to be those active management fire people. And we like to start referring to ourselves not just as firefighters, but fire managers. And a good example was last year in Sequoia National Park, we were able to conduct a Sherman prescribed burn. And not only was it a really important prescribed burn because of its location in Giant Forest next to the General Sherman tree, but when we did that prescribed burn after the 4th of July and one of the busiest part of one of the busiest national parks in the nation. We talked to over 10,000 people in just a week while we were doing that prescribed burn. And we were fortunate that we had no complaints. And I hit on that moment because you're starting to see from not only our local visitors and residents, but you're also starting to see that public acceptance from our international visitors. Nearly 40% of our visitors to Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks come from other countries where fire may not be as big of an issue as it is here in the Western United States. And so we kind of look at some of that education, but it's also when those opportunities exist, because our first job foremost is the protection of life and property. And as we look at climate change and we look at what's become from fire season to now is referred to as a fire year, it's finding those windows in those places. And sometimes we get asked questions about, well, can we do it in January or February when there's less visitation or the air is better? But as any firefighter will tell you, it's really hard to conduct a prescribed burn when it's covered with snow. And so, unfortunately, sometimes those best opportunities to do those prescribed burns are when the weather is more ideal for either public visitation or just tourism in general.
So we just have a minute before we need to wrap up, but Adam, I'd like to give you the last word. You've talked about that there is the will to do more prescribed burns. I wonder if you could talk about the resources to do that work. Are there sufficient staffing and resources necessary to do prescribed burns at the rate at which the experts think needs to happen?
I would say at the pace and scale that we need to apply fire to the landscape, we don't have enough. If you look at any agency, you know, the way that they operate is they have their firefighters that fight fires all summer long. And then typically when fire season starts to die down, you have your shoulder seasons, which is when, you know, the prescribed burning occurs. So it's, you know, it becomes very challenging with a seasonal workforce to try to squeeze in a prescribed burn on these shoulder seasons when firefighters have been taxed all summer long. And so we need to develop a different system where we can meet that need and we have the people to do it. And one thing just to add to the climate, I guess one of the silver linings with, you know, the climates warming up the way they are is it's going to lengthen our shoulder seasons that we have. So we should have longer burn windows that go further into the winter that we can utilize. The challenge is the personnel and the access to the people during that time of the season. Our fire season and our systems aren't designed to have that bulk of firefighters all the way through the winter. So I think those are the things that we need to look at, and that's the way that we will be able to keep up with that pace and scale that's needed.
Adam Hernandez, Mike Thune, John Abatsoglu, thank you so much for being with us.
No problem. Thank you for having me,
Tim. Thank you.